Welcome to Red Meat, a collection of the tastiest tidbits from Odyssey's conservative news talk radio stations across the country, a place where we're not afraid to dig in. Today we're catching you up on what's going on in the nation's capital. And we mean it literally. What in the holy heck is going on in Washington, D.C.? Donald Trump said, "The local government of the District of Columbia has lost control of public order and safety in the city," citing the case of two Israeli embassy staffers murdered in May, a congressional staffer who was shot and killed, and a Trump administration staffer who was recently beaten. He said that he directed Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth to mobilize the District of Columbia National Guard and order members to active service in such numbers as he deems necessary to address the epidemic of crime in our nation's capital. Furthermore, Trump said he directed Hegseth to coordinate with state governors and authorize the orders of any additional members of the National Guard to active service as he deems necessary and appropriate to augment this mission. Fox News Radio's Ryan Schmelz joins Mark Cox at KFTK to talk about what's going on in D.C.
Mayor Muriel Bowser does not like what's going on in Washington, D.C. She does not want the federal government to come in and clean up the mess that she was incapable or unwilling to clean up over the past couple years. And here's my point about this. And I think what's going on in D.C. is the exact same thing that's gone on in St. Louis. They are manipulating the crime numbers, in my opinion, to make them seem lower than they are. And the excuse has been, well, the way we count crime doesn't directly line up with the FBI uniform crime statistics approach, and therefore not everything gets reported to the FBI crime statistics report, and therefore we look better in the FBI uniform crime reporting statistics, right?
Yeah.
And I suspected that was the case. And then yesterday I heard a guy on, and let me find this bite here. I heard the guy on was it MSNBC? I don't know if I pulled the bite yet or not, but he basically pointed out the same thing. He said, "I think Muriel Bowser hedged her comment yesterday because she knows the truth about those crime statistics." Remember, Tashara Jones wanted to argue that St. Louis crimes are down and there's no reason for a state takeover and blah, 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 blah. But in reality, those numbers were fudged a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They are. And it's like the point that Jeanine Pirro made yesterday, and that was, well, you know, it's fine for you to say that the numbers are down, but they're still unacceptable, and we don't have to live like this. And I think she's absolutely right. There's no reason for a big city like D.C. to live like that. There was a television news anchor on ABC, Kara Phillips, yesterday, who was basically making the same point. She's like, listen, I've lived in D.C. for years. She said yesterday, I was robbed just down the street from the bureau 2 years ago. And we had somebody's car stolen this morning. She admitted this on ABC News yesterday. I don't know Kara Phillips. I don't know anything about her. For ABC News to have one of their anchors agree with Donald Trump was a pretty stunning development. She's like, you can argue the crime numbers are down. Here's the truth.
We've been talking so much about the numbers, and yeah, usually that's how you play devil's advocate, is you talk about, oh, well, stats say crime is down. However, I can tell you firsthand here in downtown D.C. where we work, right here around our bureau, just in the past 6 months, you know, there were two people shot, one person died, literally two blocks down here from the bureau. It was within the last 2 years that I actually was jumped walking just two blocks down from here. And then just this morning, one of my coworkers said her car was stolen a block away from the bureau. So we can talk about the numbers going down, but crime is happening every single day because we're all experiencing it firsthand while working and living down here.
Yeah.
I wonder what kind of reaction she received from her bosses or her coworkers.
I'm sure they don't want her to be honest about it.
Right.
But when I visited D.C. the last time, and I told Annie this when she went there, when she got to go up and be in the press briefing room a month or two ago, I'm like, listen, I'll just tell you what they told me when I went there. Griff Jenkins told me this, a couple of other people. Yes, there are some nice restaurants that aren't that far from your hotel. If I were you, if it's daylight, it's probably safe to walk to them. Take an Uber on your way back. Do not mm-hmm. walk back five city blocks from that restaurant to this hotel in the dark.
Wouldn't you say the same thing, though, about most of downtown St. Louis?
Parts of St. Louis.
Daylight, I'd probably be comfortable walking by myself. At night, there's no way. If I'm by myself, even maybe if I'm with somebody else,
yeah.
depending on who it is, am I walking even five blocks? Maybe I'm a baby about that, but I've seen too many things happening right here.
I think a lot of people, safe. A lot of people feel that way, and there's no excuse for it. There really isn't. And I'm glad what the president's doing in D.C. Everybody who's claiming it's an overreach doesn't understand that D.C. is operated by Congress for the most part. They're funded by them, and they have a huge influence in the administration, a huge influence over what goes on there. So you just need to grow up and get over that one.
The laws are weak. I can't touch you if you're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old and you have a gun. I convict someone of shooting another person with an illegal gun on a public bus in the chest, intent to kill. I convict him. And you know what the judge gives him? Probation. Says you should go to college. We need to go after the D.C. Council and their absurd laws.
Yeah, Jeanine Pirro there, the U.S. attorney, talking yesterday at this news conference the president held on crime in the D.C. area. I mean, it was pretty wide-ranging. This thing went on for a long time. The president took all questions. Of course, a lot of it focused on his plans to clean up Metro D.C. We've got Ryan Schmelz on the line with us this morning from Fox News Radio.
We believe that eventually there will be 700 or 800 or so National Guard troops deployed to the area. And what they're going to be doing, I think it still remains to be seen. You know, there are some legal authorities that the National Guard and just the military in general don't have when it comes to, you know, making law enforcement arrests or doing crowd control or crime control. So what their specific job is going to be, I think we're still kind of trying to feel that out and see what that's going to be.
Yeah, you know, Ryan, I'm interested in your take on it. I mentioned to Kim, I used to come up here for that Federation for American Immigration Reform conference every year.
Yeah.
And the last time I was in D.C., I remember having a conversation with a couple of the network reporters there, and I'm like, hey, what do you think of this restaurant or that restaurant? I was trying to figure out a place to go eat. And they're like, yeah, it's fine. It's about six blocks from your hotel. So if you're going before dark, it's probably safe to walk over there, but I would take an Uber home. Don't walk back from there in the dark. Like that was a couple of years ago when people were warning yeah. about that. What's your sense of living and working in that area?
I think that's kind of a sentiment that a lot of people feel. You know, I live in the Navy Yard area, which is where Nats Park is, and that's a place that has, I would say most days I feel safe, but we have a crime every once in a while, and it is just the wildest thing you'll ever see, the stuff that what happens. You know, we've had a couple fatal shootings at the Metro stop by in Navy Yard. We've had, you know, a shooting at the building across the street from me, and I believe there was another shooting over the weekend at one of the buildings here. So it's been happening. There certainly is a big concern that people have here, but, what's interesting too is, you know, the teenagers that President Trump was referencing yesterday, Navy Yard actually went into a curfew recently for juveniles because that issue had become such a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the problem. We've had that here in St. Louis, and quite frankly, it doesn't do much. If it's not really enforced because they have bigger yeah. fish to fry, you're still going to have the crime. And so that's why I would argue that this is necessary, this federal takeover. Are they going to be there indefinitely? Is that the plan? There's no, you know, obviously we don't have an exact start date, but we don't have an end date either, right? It's just however long they're needed.
Legally, he has about 30 days without any type of congressional approval after that to take action here. So the clock is ticking when this official, you know, takeover of the D.C. Police Department goes into effect. So So, you know, Congress gets back in a month, less than a month, I would say now, and they would probably have to extend it at some point. So he is a little limited in terms of how long he's allowed to do this for and what specifically he can do.
Yeah, very true. Well, Ryan, be safe up there, my friend. Thank you.
I'll do my best. Thank you. Thank you both.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Ryan Schmel's there up in D.C. this morning. He lives there. You were listening to him. He said he sees some crazy stuff not too far from the Capitol building. Yeah, honestly, it's not unlike St. Louis. And if you look at the overall crime stats, it's worse here technically than it is in D.C. Statistically,
per capita.
Right. It's worse in St.
But,
Louis.
But we don't have world leaders coming to St. Louis on a regular basis. We don't have the White House here. We don't have all these things that D.C. has.
But when we do, we clean up the homeless problem.
Right, that's right. There's all of a sudden a project to restore the city hall.
Here's Tara Servatius with more on what she thinks is going on in D.C.
Which way are we going to live? And Trump has said, no, I'm taking it back.
Sounds like all D.C. needs is a new mayor.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. You put a new mayor in there, somebody who's not a Marxist, somebody who doesn't apply this system, and that things will be fine. You turn this around 6 months if you want to. Colleen Stimson describes how we got here.
Look, there's three parts that he has to focus on. The front end, yes, arrest people who are committing crimes. But the middle end is resource the U.S. Attorney's Office, where I used to work, lower the decline to prosecute rate, handle gun cases in federal district court, especially these felons who are all prosecuted in superior court, with 1% get a prison sentence. And then on the back end, make sure you put good judges on the superior court. If you don't fix all three, the problem's going to remain. I mean, the president can certainly, I mean, he put Jeanine Pirro in. She's going to be a great prosecutor. She has a great track record. But, and he can appoint 10 more judges to the vacancies on the superior court. But the D.C. City Council treats 20-year-olds as juveniles. And so the D.C. City Council's to blame here. In Maryland and Virginia, the age of responsibility is 14 or below.
See, so that's what that's how they do that. This is crime that is very much wanted and celebrated. Do you see? I don't know if you saw this lady, Jeanine Pirro. She's on Fox News last week. She's talking to Laura Ingraham. She gives out her personal email and says, you know, one of the ways that the Biden administration made sure the criminals were unmolested and could roam free in D.C. was by simply not replacing the judges there. And not replacing the prosecutors there, the federal prosecutors. She said her office has a third of her office is unstaffed, and she said they did it on purpose because no prosecutors means you could have a good dual justice system. She didn't say that, but you know they could roam free. Nobody could get them. They're understaffed. And she gave out her Judge Jeanine gave out her personal email and said, "Hey, listen, if you want to come be a federal prosecutor for me, send me your resume. I need to move fast. I need to handle this myself just to staff it up to go after these criminals." Well, that was a deliberate tactic of the Democrats. They want to lose control of this territory, Lee. They want it gone. They want chaos. Basically, because in their moral system, you cannot prosecute criminals. Again, they're oppressed class.
Well, I think they want this as one of the territories like, you know, the other territories that we have that they want to annex and make states so that they can get, you know, two more senators and other congressional seats and, you know, continue their power grab.
Yeah. And Trump's agreed to fight back. Look, I'm telling you what, man, commie wins. In New York, we'll have to take that back, too. That's gone.
Well, he's already got Fox News had somebody on from one of their representatives who was from the city, though, telling his constituents, leave.
Yeah.
Leave, because this is where
the Democrat Party
is headed. The Democrat Party is apparently in charge. This is the guy that's probably going to be the next mayor. Get out while you can.
Yeah, he's got over 50% of the vote now. And unfortunately, the other people running against him combined don't have as much, at least in polling, as he does. Yes, this is the time to sell commercial real estate and get the heck out. Trump's decided to fight. We'll see how it goes. So this is what Trump is going to war with. This is what this is about. And you can see the outlines of what it will take. Folks, it's mind-boggling to think the mess that 4 years of Democrats has created and what it's going to take to clean it up. An internal ICE army, because Jake, this is an army, 75,000 strong. Think about that, 75,000 strong. I mean, we are repurposing the military for the war. What is the war? The war is against the Democrat merged cartels for America, with the specific goal of making sure we retain control, sovereign control of all American territory, that these post-constitutional, post-American blue areas can be reconquered and will not fall to the cartels as merged with the Democrat Party. I've never seen anything like it. It's fascinating. And it's a relief, too, because, folks, it's got to be destroyed. It's not good enough. I mean, you give them another 4 years, they steal the next election. Can you even imagine where we'll be? Yeah, I'll tell you exactly where we'll be. Next, and Trump aims to win it. This is war. It truly is. You're watching The Holding Facility for the Enemy, record size U.S. military building, largest detention center ever built. 75,000 strong internal army to clean up the Democrat Party and Joe Biden's mess, round up all them illegals. But folks, remember this from last week. Everything you're seeing in the last 2 weeks is part of this war. So this is a war. It starts now. And it's a war for our future. It's a war to determine, are we going to have no-go zones in America controlled by Democrats and cartels? We'll see. It's going to be wild to watch this. And the media is going to scream bloody murder with the first cartel boss we drone. I mean, you're going to think he was the coolest guy on earth. They're going to grieve. But these guys have to be taken out. We got to do it fast. If we can't hunt them and round them up, then we need to drone them. One way or the other. Hundreds of millions of dollars spent on wall panels. Supposed to be erected. Trump's wall. The big bollard wall. The one that works. 21, Joe Biden said, no, we're not building the wall. And he wanted to make sure that nobody else could either. So he sold it off for pennies on the dollar, made it go away. Here's Trump on that, on the campaign trail.
We ordered an additional 200 miles of wall. It's very expensive. And now it's about double the price of what it would have been 6 years ago. And the administration is trying to sell it for 5 cents on the dollar, knowing that we're getting ready to put it up. And what they're doing is really an act. It's almost a criminal act.
Oh, absolutely. Folks, I play this to remind you, none of this was an accident. None of this is because oopsie doopsie Joe is senile and he forgot to secure the border. This is deliberate. Story has a happy ending because they found the border wall. They haven't sold or destroyed all of it. Take a listen.
The auction house that listed up to $350 million worth of unused border wall material now says it plans to return some of those materials to the federal government. Here's the quote. GovPlanet has reached an agreement working with the Office of the Border Czar to return border wall materials that were previously deemed surplus and sourced by the federal government to GovPlanet via existing contracts. We are expediting the transfer of these materials and support the administration's border protection plans. Former President Biden halted construction in 2021 and sold the material to the auction house with bids starting as low as $5.
They got it. They got it back. And a lot of it is going to be installed. There's also funding to complete Trump's wall. Dish up, get it sunk into the ground. It will make a big difference.
Newell Norman at WWL Radio wants to talk more about what counts as high crime and if it makes sense for the National Guard to help out in the nation's capital. Why really are people upset about this?
You've probably heard by now that President Donald Trump has deployed the National Guard to D.C. as well as federal law enforcement agents there to crack down on crime and homelessness in the city. Now, there are a lot of people talking about a lot of different things relative to this and saying that, you know, D.C.'s the safest that it's been in 30 years. Okay. So what does that mean? So we're going to try and define and engage in a conversation with former Chief Serpas about what is high crime? What is it? We talk about it all the time, but how do you judge it? How do you quantify high crime? And then once we get through that, we're going to talk about whether or not short-term versus long-term strategies are what is actually needed here. Seems as though they have a lot of crime reported and a lot of juvenile crime that goes unresolved. Does that sound familiar? It's some of the same issues that we have going on here in the city, where in large measure, a lot of what we're doing relative to our juvenile offenders is a nothing burger. We're not dealing with it. And when we have alternative to incarceration programs, we're not following up. We're not making sure that they're hitting all of the mileposts that they need to hit in order to come out from under the jurisdiction of the court. We've seen that these stories repeated over and over and over again. We've seen incredibly high recidivism rates. Is this just the policies of what's going on? Now, Congress has a lot of authority in the District of Columbia. There are a lot of policies coming out of the D.C. Council that, you know, are kind of head scratchers. We're kind of avoiding dealing with juvenile crime. In fact, most of the folks in mainstream media, they're not even talking about it. They're not even reporting the flavor of what is actually going on there, because it got so defensive because we have a Democrat mayor and a Republican president who's very aggressive and very proactive and seems to be a man of action. I don't always agree with what he's going to do. But the fact of the matter is that if we can't be safe in the nation's capital that has access to more funds than other cities traditionally and historically, because they're in the nation's capital. But what we have seen is a hodgepodge of policies coming out of there, a misuse, improper spending of dollars. We've elected people that are dope fiends, drug addicts, to serve as mayor. We have had more internal theft going on there. In fact, just recently, they fired a police commander for fudging the numbers to try and make it look like it's not nearly as bad as it once was. We've had this complete total breakdown in the governance of this issue. We had this particular mayor, Muriel Bowser, who for years during COVID was hell-bent on walking to the beat of a different drum, contrary to the safety and security of her families, being incredibly onerous as it relates to some gatherings, but no big deal to put, you know, 25,000 people in the street to protest something. COVID's not going to spread there. It's a COVID-free zone, kind of like a sanctuary city. Wasn't going to be a problem at all. And we wonder why we find ourselves in the predicament that we find ourselves. Instead of just governing, right? Just governing. Not getting all wrapped up in the social warfare, ideological warfare, being in the nation's capital. And what ultimately happened? The place became Ghost Town USA. The D.C. economy ended up in shambles. And any time that you have distress, opportunities for jobs and other things of that nature, what is the byproduct of that? Typically more crime. Now, I'm not one to believe that those are the only contributors as it relates to crime, and that when you do aggressive policing, that you're going to actually make matters worse. A lot of these things go hand in glove with one another. The liberal bent wants to try and make you believe that access to health care, access to jobs, access to opportunities are the panacea as it relates to crime, violent crime in an area. Well, D.C.'s had that in the past. What was the excuse then? D.C. has always been one of the most violent crime cities in America. D.C.'s always had a relaxed attitude about enforcement. It's been an incredibly liberal-led city that has been very progressive for a long time, making excuses for crime as opposed to holding people accountable. And they become the victim of just kind of the blank check mentality, especially if there's a Democratic leader in the White House. They get what they want, when they want, how they want, and they get used to that. And when things change, it's hard to get off of that financial tit. And they don't really actually know what to do at that point in time because they're actually not governing. It's easy to do things when you have unlimited funds going your way, little resistance in front of you, and you're able to embark on whatever journey you want to embark on without having to really figure out what the financial morass might be as a result of decisions that you are having to make. Because if you get into a pickle, you call Big Daddy in the White House and you get another check. You get another grant. You get access to another program. They became the social laboratory, and they received the funding to do so about all kinds of different programs that were going to be tried there. And, you know, in the end, when we look back historically, they've still had an issue. So I don't know that this is going to be the right move. I have my doubts about it, but I certainly can understand that there should be a desire in this country that the nation's capital be one of the safest cities in America. That's where we invite other political leaders from around the country. Most people take a lot of pride in their nation's capital to show it off. This is what we're about. You've heard me say this a million times. Human nature is the first impression is the lasting impression. The impression of this country when you visit D.C. is not very good. It hadn't been good for years. It's not a city that you can just walk around without looking over your shoulder all the time. And what's interesting is if they did probably a private poll of mainstream media folks, what you will find, a large majority of them have been victims of crime in D.C. If you did a private poll of interns, both Republicans, Democrats, and independents, what you will find is that a large proportion of them have been victims of crime in D.C. If you talk to restaurateurs that are there, what you will find is that historically they've had trouble being able to staff these restaurants, incredible restaurants, some of the finest restaurants in the country, with the appropriate staff in D.C. for a whole host of reasons. And they've had kind of an artificial economy, artificial to the extent they're very much like New Orleans, where they're wedded to the tourism industry, but they have a business community spend there during the day and at night that has been a lot easier in many respects for folks to achieve some level of success, other than the fact that taxes are high and property values are higher as well. So the entry cost is a little steep. But there are a lot of people used to be at one point in time walking the streets of D.C., not any longer. And now D.C. is going to cry because there's a movement to right-size federal government. Because you see, the more people that the federal government employs, the better D.C. does on a whole bunch of different fronts. Now they're having to look internally as to alternatively how they're going to be able to survive. Now more than ever, there's a need and a desire to have someone who can actually govern and can pull this city through the challenges that it faces. And the first challenge, not unlike all other cities, we know this better than most, is to address crime and safety. Because if you don't address crime and safety, you're not going anywhere fast. You don't have to be a brain surgeon to figure that out. Now, there are a lot of restrictions, and we'll talk about that with Ronald Surpass when he joins us in just a few minutes. about this move for the Guard and federal law enforcement authorities going into D.C. proper. But we know all too well the downstream implications of not being serious about making sure that you have an impact on juvenile crime. We know all too well when you have progressive judges, lenient judges, that want to make excuses for juvenile offenders that commit violent crime. We know all too well of the impact generationally that some of these players have in this city, because we've coddled and we babysat these offenders for so many years. It's amazing how some of these judges actually view their role. They believe a success is being able to keep a kid out of trouble during their juvenile years, not whether there's still the high propensity for that juvenile to get in trouble, but they view themselves as getting them out of trouble by being lenient when they do get caught, where they're not spending a lot of time. They're not developing a significant criminal history, so to speak. Not that much of that is going to matter anyway, because it's kept a secret, right? They view that as a success. In my view, a success would be if we do a three-year look back 3 years after reaching majority. Where do we find these individuals that have gone through these programs that have been implemented by juvenile courts? Did they make a meaningful impact on that young adult? Be interesting to see where we find these offenders 3 years after reaching the age of majority. I suggested that for probably 20 years. No one wants to do it. Wonder why? I suspect it's because they already know what the outcome is going to reveal. It will be pretty but ugly. And I can't imagine that it's going to be too terribly different in any other city across the country. But if we really want to get serious about dealing with juvenile crime, that is how we should view, in my humble opinion, the success or failure of programs that we deploy and the millions upon millions of dollars that we're spending in doing so. The proverbial ROI. Are we getting the return on our investment? Are we really moving kids? Are we helping with the development of a moral compass? These kids understand the concept of right from wrong. The real question is, do they give a damn? A lot don't. But unless and until we get serious about this, we're going to be right back in the situation that D.C. finds itself right now. The amount of D.C. violent crime that's perpetrated by juveniles is horrendous. Horrendous. Ronald, welcome to the show.
Hey, Newell. It's always good to be with you. How are you?
Good. Ronnie, I want to try and approach this this way. Get to the question of, you know, sending the feds in into D.C., we have a lot of folks that are saying that D.C. is the safest that it's been in 30 years. And that very well may be true. But how do you define high crime? I mean, let's tackle that first, because if you look at President Trump's release, he says that in 2024, D.C. saw a homicide rate of 27.3 per 100,000 residents, the fourth highest homicide rate in the country, six times higher than New York City, higher than Atlanta, Chicago, and Compton. And if D.C. was a state, it would have the highest homicide rate of any state in the nation. In 2012, the homicide rate in D.C. was just 13.9 per 100,000 residents. Their population has been pretty stable. It's grown here recently by about 35,000 people. They have a population of around 702,250. So how do you define high crime? Where do you start?
Well, I think the first thing is there's none so blind as those who refuse to see. 27 homicides per 100,000 is going to drop to 24 if they have a better year this year versus 13 just a decade ago. So you got to see what you got to see. Secondly, you and I've talked about this before. The government measures crime data. Secondly, we know that the government data is half wrong just because people don't call. thirdly, a D.C. police commander was suspended in May for fudging the crime numbers. And fourth, crime is a perception that people feel from what they hear from their friends, families, and neighbors, more so true to them than anything else we just said. So, you know, when you and I were in this business, you half a century, me only 45 parts of a century, I think we both knew intuitively that a crowd of people don't really give a damn about your crime numbers. They care that they don't feel safe, that their neighbor said they was robbed, their family member says they lost their car. So that's the quagmire that I think politicians are stuck in because they somehow or another believe, many, not all, that these crime numbers are mythical and they're magical and they can make everything all better. They don't. People feel crime. The government reports numbers. People feel crime.
And then when you look at, I've never been one to really believe that the homicide rate was really reflective of the overall crime of violence rate in a community or other types of crimes, because a lot of those murders, as we well know, are relational. The victim and the perpetrator know one another. There's a conflict that brings them to that confrontation, which is different than a lot of other crimes, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. And from a research point of view, when we know everything that we can know about a murder or a sexual assault, generally about 8 times out of 10, there was some sort of a knowledge between the people of one another. Robberies, on the other hand, be they with a weapon, which is an armed robbery, or with a fist, which is a simple robbery, those are almost 90% somebody you don't know. When someone breaks into your car, right? Oh, Lou, this is a good point. You and I had to deal with this a lot. We count crimes the way the FBI said to crown them, going all the way back to the 1930s. They determined in this crime capture mechanism that we still use today that a property crime is a burglary. Well, there ain't nothing more personal to anybody on earth than somebody breaking into their house. So again, the crime data misleads people to think that somehow or another the government thinks burglary is less important than getting beat up. It's more important because you're the victim. So as you said, crimes of murder, crimes of sexual assault, they almost always know one another in some way. That doesn't make it better. It just means that's what we know. But if you're walking down the street and somebody punches you in the back of the head, a group of juveniles, and takes your wallet, yeah, that's a serious violent crime to you.
Absolutely. And, you know, so it's kind of interesting because there's a split in the mainstream media as to is this necessary? Is it as bad as what the president is saying, you know, that crime is on the decrease there? That's why I wanted to start with, well, what is high crime? I mean, you know, and I think you laid it out perfectly as to what it really is and the feeling that people have in their community, the place that they call home. So let's talk about
Absolutely. Going
in now. So we go in, and this is where I have some of my bigger problems with this, is that, you know, this short-term versus long-term strategy. And what is it that we can actually do? Because without congressional approval, it looks like the president has the authority to kind of do things in about 30-day snippets there, with the exception of federal law enforcement and tasking them to do certain things inside of the district. Your thoughts?
I think that might speak to something I'm as expert as you, and that would be this. If the president and the statutes, and I'm sure you've already covered this with the audience, he's using a particular statute that's unique to the D.C. government that is part of the relationship historically between the federal government and the District of Columbia. So that's a statute that has nothing to do with the Insurrection Act. But I think your point about 30 days is really crucially important, because if they were to make a big difference in 30 days, then maybe that's all they would kind of get done to put pressure on the local government to perform differently. I don't know. I'm like you, I have some questions in my mind how much you could really get done in 30 days. But I also know this. If you were living in Avondale in the 80s and 90s, or you were living in the Ninth Ward in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, 20s, and anybody said they were going to do anything to try to help you self safer, they felt good about it.
Oh, they would absolutely support it.
For the yeah.
For the most part. I mean, it's interesting to hear the leadership of D.C. and their reaction. I mean, this is like a threat to democracy. This is all over. Well, I got to imagine if you interviewed.
The threat to democracy is the councilman who got reelected after taking bribes that he's going on trial for. I mean, that's when it starts to become very political and kind of silly. Now, I can't disclose everything because I am a professional consultant. I happen to know a lot about that place in very recent times. And like many large departments, they're struggling with things that everybody does. Recruitment, retention, equipment, very strict labor rules about employment and such. But that doesn't mean they can't learn and they can't do better things. Chuck Ramsey, a dear friend of mine and yours, went there with all those same questions and all those same quarrels, and he made a huge difference. The question is, who's going to make a huge difference? If the president thinks he can make a huge difference in 30 days, maybe it'll just be enough to spark them thinking differently from where they are today.
What's it like to live in D.C. right now? The host of Brian and Company at WTIC Radio finds out next.
You know, a good friend of mine from college lived in a pretty rough neighborhood, you know, with the metal on the windows and everything like that. I'm just curious, has it changed for you over the last decade in terms of feeling safe and what you see on a daily basis?
Yeah, it's really changed over the last decade that I've been here. I mean, and again, you know, about half my time here has been during COVID. So obviously there's been, you know, decreases in crime when there was lockdown, and then everyone came out of lockdown and that changed a bit. And then D.C. had a bit of a crime surge in 2023. But over the last 2 years, it's decreased. And you know, at the same time, you know, you can parse data all you want, but I know a lot of people go based on perception and if they've experienced crime and what they've been able to see. So, you know, everyone has a bit of a different experience, but it's been in ebbs and flows. But at least based on the data right now, I mean, DC is in a decline of violent crime. And so I think that's left a lot of people wondering, what role the National Guard will play, federal agents, what the end goal is. I still wonder what the barometer for success will look like for President Trump, you know, when this 30 days is met and if he decides to extend it or get Congress involved.
Yeah, almost separate from that, because I don't know what the DEA or the National Guard would have to do with it. But for me, D.C. is different, right? Because it has all these monuments and these incredible museums, and it's such a important piece of our culture, right? And so I'm curious, do you see more or less, like, whether it's homeless people in certain places or things aren't as pristine as maybe they were or could be? Like, I feel like our monuments and stuff should be really in really great shape as people from all over the world come to see us. This is a representation of who we are. What does that look like?
That's hard to say. I mean, as someone who has lived here for over a decade, I go to museums a lot, but I'm not frequenting monuments as much just because, you know, just daily life doing different things. But I haven't gotten the indication on a personal level what I've observed of these things being under greater attack or not being pristine or clean. I think it's really a case-by-case basis. That's not to say that if you're a tourist and you're going to really popular areas of the city that you're not going to see homeless encampments or you're not going to come into contact with some sort of crime. But I think the indication, and I'm someone who grew up in New Jersey, so I frequented New York City a lot. And so, you know, whether I feel like I experienced D.C. differently than maybe even New York in terms of cleanliness or pristine or what have you. But, you know, I think it's really based on perception. And I think, you know, this is all to say that President Trump has had a pretty adversarial relationship with D.C. since the beginning. And so this is, you know, not the most surprising, but definitely unprecedented.
Yeah, it's interesting to point out. I mean, Muriel Bowser, she tried resistance in the first, you know, this has been written about a lot in the last day, tried resistance in the first term, is trying cooperation and end up with the, you know, very similar results in terms of the relationship with the White House. We're talking with Lisa Hagan with CT Mirror here on Brian and Company. I'm curious on another front before I get to some more of your repertorial stuff. Do you notice whether tourism is up or down there? You know, obviously there's all this where, you know, fewer people might be coming to the States, you know, fewer Americans maybe traveling abroad. Does it feel any different at all, or is it still crazy crowded?
wouldn't say it feels totally different. Yeah, I do wonder from like an international tourism perspective, if people are coming here as much. I don't know the extent of that. But no, I mean, it's D.C. in the summer always gets really crowded. It's so hot here and humid. I know it's not that different from Connecticut, but it's pretty brutal down here. But people flock and come down here regardless and are visiting museums and really, you know, popular tourist spots. So I haven't seen a huge market difference in, you know, my decade of being down here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Red Meat. Don't forget to smash that subscribe button for your favorite tasty assortment of conservative audio. And follow your local Odyssey talk station to get shows from these hosts delivered daily wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, stay hungry.